The message you are about to hear is brought to you by Terry Moore. And now, Mr. Moore.
There was a young boy who had just gotten his driver's permit. And he went to his father, who was a minister in a Christian congregation, and he wanted to discuss with him the use of the car. Well, his father said to him, "You know, son, I'll make a deal with you. I'd like you to bring up your grades from a C to a B. I'd like you to start to study the Bible a little more often. And I'd like you to get a haircut. And after this is done, then we'll talk about the use of the car." Well, the boy paused for a minute, and then he said, "Okay, I'll do it." Because he really wanted to drive the car. You could imagine being this age, wanting to get in the driver's seat. Well, about 6 weeks had passed, and the boy then went to his father, who was sitting in the study, and his father said, "Son, I'm really proud of you. You've brought your grades up. You've been studying the Bible more. And I see that you've been participating in study groups and church. But I'm also a little disappointed because you still haven't gotten your hair cut." Well, the son paused and then replied, "You know, Dad, I've been thinking about that. And in my studies in the Bible, I noticed that Samson had long hair. I noticed that John the Baptist had long hair. And in some of the biblical TV shows I see, many of them are often portrayed with long hair." And his dad then paused and looked at him and said, "Son, yes, but did you also notice that these people walked everywhere they went?" You know, there's many seats to sit in life. You could sit behind the driver's seat. You can sit in an airline seat as a passenger on an airplane. You could sit in the seat of a roller coaster. And there's also seats of position in life, aren't there? You could have the position of the pastor in a congregation and sit in that seat. You could sit in an airline pilot's seat. You could be a secretary of a company. You could be an accounting executive and hold that seat. Or you could sit in the seat of a CEO, which I imagine are very plush and wonderful big seats to sit in, very comfortable seat. Some people may even sit in the seat of a president. Let's turn over to Psalms in chapter 1 today, Psalms in chapter 1. In Psalms, the first chapter, I would like to point out that there's one seat spoken of here that many people today sit in. Psalms in chapter 1. And we're going to begin reading in verse 1, where it says, "Blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor standeth in the way of sinners, nor sitteth in the seat of the scornful." This particular psalm, the first psalm in this book, doesn't have an author, but it's likely that it was David, as it carries the same style of the other psalms that are attributed to his name. But it begins with a statement of fact, and it begins like Christ's Beatitudes in Matthew. Blessed are you for doing this, and blessed are you for not doing that. And he starts by saying, blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly. Well, this word blessed here is the Hebrew word esher, which means to be happy. And it also comes from a word that means to be honest and straight, level-headed. And the word walketh here, I think we all know, is referring to behavior, the way you walk in life, the things you do. Counsel is taking advice or the plans of somebody. And ungodly, I think we all know, is those who are morally wrong, who are wicked people, actively bad people. So he begins this psalm by stating, happy is the man who is honest and does not follow the advice, the plans of the ungodly, wicked person or wicked people. And then he says, nor stands in the way of the sinners. And this means to arise, to stand, to dwell in a course of life or action that is governed by sinners, by people who actively do wrong things. He does not abide or dwell in the way of those who sin. Well, we all sin, don't we? All of us sin. But those who seek righteousness turn to the right when the sin is discovered. And we work to remove that sin out of our lives. It will not remain. But instead we take action, we repent of the sin, and change our course of life to be that after the godly. Refocusing, renavigating, back, putting ourselves back on track by God, with the power of God's Spirit. But then the psalmist addresses the epitome of the ungodly, the resting place of those who practice sin. Blessed are those who do not sit in the seat of the scornful, who do not dwell in the place where people mock and scoff, deride others, deride God. Mockery, contempt, derision. This is not a place where we want to be. And this is not a place where we are to be. Take no counsel of the wicked and no rest in this seat, because none are going to be given, ultimately, to those who sit in this seat, the seat of the scornful. And this seat is a position that's held by those who openly reject the God of this Bible, who mock and say things contrary to what God proclaims as truth and righteousness, ridiculing, having contempt for God and those who follow Him. And we see a lot of this today, don't we? We see a lot of it in the news, in the media, on television, in the newspapers, and the channels, the news channels by the anchor persons. We see a lot of this. And there's a lot of other avenues that voice opinions that are stated as so-called facts. They scoff at the morals and the principles of the God of this Bible. They mock our God with their self-believed truths and their self-believed higher thoughts of education, thinking that the people during these times were just weak and not very bright. Well, journalism, I believe, has a particularly strong anti-God bias in virtually every magazine and newspaper and news channel that you're going to watch or read today. And there was a very interesting article I had read on the internet written by Lauren Mitchell, and it's called Media Bias in America. And I'm going to read you parts of this article. Just bear with me, it'll take a couple of minutes, but I think it's very interesting. It kind of helps us to put things in perspective about how anti-God and anti-Christian the media truly are in this country. It states, "You are from a large city in America. You haven't attended church in years and claim no particular religious affiliation. You don't believe in God, but you do hold lots of other beliefs, such as women's rights to an abortion, and homosexuality is okay. You voted Democrat in every presidential election. You oppose school prayer, capital punishment, defense spending, and aid to anti-communist forces. You are a self-described liberal, rabidly anti-Christian, and pathetically out of touch with the mainstream. Yet, oddly enough, that mainstream looks to you each day for information. Who are you? You are a reporter or a TV anchorman. You work for a major daily newspaper or perhaps a magazine or one of the networks. You write for the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times, Newsweek, or Time magazine. You and other anti-American, anti-Christian liberals have the eyes and ears and the hearts of the American public. America trusts you. Through a series of 9 polls, the 1981 Lichter-Rothman study served on political attitudes and voting patterns of 240 journalists. These journalists were taken from the New York Times, the Washington Post, U.S. News, the Wall Street Journal, as well as the major television networks. Key findings included 90% favored abortion, 80% supported affirmative action, and most of them blamed the U.S. for third world poverty. The survey of the media elite and future reporters found that more than 80% of each group seldom or never attend religious services, and less than 8% of them attend church regularly. Nearly half of them claim no religious affiliation. That's pretty staggering numbers for those who feed us information every day, those who people look to for truth, for guidance, for information. And then he sums up the article saying, "There was a time when the nation's leading newspapers took seriously the kingship of Jesus Christ, when Monday's edition included lengthy reports on Sunday sermons." Obviously, he is probably Protestant or Catholic. "Many fail to recognize that the hideous profile of the modern media is the direct result of its wholesale rejection of Christ." I think that's very fitting, isn't it? Even though this person might not be a true Christian, he's a little misguided in his religious beliefs, he wrote some things that are very true here. And they really are interesting. This article, brethren, was written nearly 15 years ago, in 1991. But everything it states stands true today. In fact, it is worse. It has gotten worse in the last 15 years. One of the few media programs that will give some kind of minor attention to the Christian perspective is a program called Talking Points on Fox News. And during one of these particular programs, I have an excerpt from this, they were discussing Harriet Myers, who was about to be elected to the Supreme Court. And I'd like to read just a brief couple of statements from this program, because it also affirms the anti-Christian media bias in our country. And it states it as being out of control. Bill O'Reilly states this: "Talking Points was not surprised this morning when Mrs. Myers was roundly criticized by syndicated columnist Molly Ivins and New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd. Both women are liberal advocates who worship at the altar of Roe versus Wade. That is, they define an American's worthiness on how that American sees abortion." We don't know how Harriet Myers sees abortion. All we know is that she is a member of an evangelical Christian church, and that's enough to disqualify her in the eyes of Ivins and Dowd. "So let's get this straight," he says. "If you belong to a conservative Christian church, these women who are journalists believe you have no right to serve your country in a decision-making capacity." I don't even think they know it, but Ivins and Dowd are espousing an anti-Christian bias, and they're not the only ones. There are a number of politicians who simply disqualify anyone from appointed positions if they oppose abortion. Talking Points believes anti-Christian bias in this country is off the chart. There's somebody who at least sheds a little bit of truth into matters. Journalists today do not believe that Christian principles are valid for our society. They see them as oppressive to women. They see them as oppressive to people of different beliefs. They see them as fiction, not reality, not applicable to modern man, because we have a higher level of thinking now, don't we? That's how they feel. And this attitude has been fueled by various other forms of media and entertainment. Yes, entertainment. Radio talk show hosts make fun of religion, and they speak of biblical stories and the examples given in this book like they're fairy tales, myth, not to be believed, not to be trusted. Movies and television also mock and scoff at Christianity and wholesome family values. Homosexuals and criminals are glorified and portrayed as the good guys in the movies. Now, of course, there are the vicious ones, the ones that are just despicable and horribly evil. But then you have the ones that are not so evil. They have a few vices and they may drink too much. Maybe they're kind of a womanizer, or they steal a little bit, but it's only from wealthy people. They're only stealing from rich people. So they're okay. Now they're the good guys, right? This is what Hollywood portrays on television and in the movies. When religious characters are portrayed in the movies, they're often the nutcases, the ones that are a little bit off their rocker, a little strange, you know, people that you really don't want to associate with, but and much less would like to be like these people. That's the religious characters that Hollywood portrays. They're seen as weak, not very bright, and that they need the Bible to give them some kind of self-confidence, what little bit of self-confidence they might have. Those are not the heroes in today's world. It's the bad guys. the bad guys who are portrayed as good guys. The strong heroic characters in television movies are the ones who cuss, the ones who gamble, the ones who drink, the ones who have sex with multiple partners. These are the heroes of Hollywood and our society, not the heroes given in this Bible, the heroes of faith. In creating these types of programs, brethren, I believe that the entertainment industry openly mock, ridicule, and scoff at the commandments of our great God, the ideals of the great ruler of the universe. They do this by their sick portrayals of what men and women are like or should be like. Let's turn over to Proverbs in chapter 1. Proverbs in chapter 1. And then we have music, don't we? Music. There's all kinds of music today. Pop music, rock music, there's alternative music, there's punk rock music, there's classical, all kinds of forms of music. But if you listen very closely, you'll see that there is no other seat of the scornful that is heard with such volume as music today. Hundreds upon thousands of musicians are chiming in with songs of hatred, disrespect, describing lascivious acts between men and women, putting down parents, putting down the family, mocking the true values of good and wholesome living. And when they do refer to God, when they actually use His name in a lot in some of their songs, they follow it with the word damn. What kind of disrespect and scorn is that? They do this, brethren, and they love it. They enjoy it. They get a kick out of it. It's a lot of fun to them. They enjoy this kind of entertainment, and those who succumb to this, who are attracted to it, they enjoy it as well. They love it. Many enjoy watching it. Many enjoy listening to it. And many people actually strive to be like these people, like the rock musicians today or the heroes of the movies. They kind of base their life around the ideals of Hollywood and the music industry. Proverbs chapter 1 and verse 22, I believe, addresses this, their love of this kind of thing. It says, "How long, you simple ones, will you love simplicity? And the scorners delight in their scorning, and fools hate knowledge." Simple ones. The word simple here is a Hebrew word pethi, which means silly or seducible ones. And simplicity means foolish. So how long, you silly, seducible people, are you going to love foolishness? How long will you scorners delight in mocking me, mocking the great God of this Bible, hating true knowledge, hating the knowledge that brings good things and the knowledge of things that are right? How long are you going to do this? This anti-God, anti-Christian agenda will not stop. It will not stop in this country, and it will not stop around the world. It's getting worse. Every year it's getting worse. Every month, even, it's getting worse. This nation that was once blessed by God is starting to experience calamity, destruction. God is allowing terrible things to happen to this nation because America continues to reject Him. These things are going to continue to happen. Even those who claim to be Christian, professing Christians, openly reject the commandments given by God, saying they're not valid. We don't have to keep them. We have grace. Christ died for us. That's all we need. I just need to believe, and that's it. They do this as their ministers molest children, as their pastors become more and more homosexual. as they allow these kinds of evils to creep into their church. They are numb to the truth. They are numb to evil and beginning to accept it themselves. Mainstream professing Christian fellowships accept these kinds of things, and it's a slap in the face to God. God says otherwise if you'd continue in Proverbs chapter 1 and verse 23. Turn you at my reproof, my correction, he says. And if you do, behold, I will pour out my spirit unto you. I will make known my words unto you. But this world has not turned, has it? No. It hasn't turned at his correction. And instead, this world rejects its own creator. And he continues to say, because I have called and you have refused, I have stretched out my hand and no man regarded, but you have set at nothing all my counsel and would have none of my reproof. I also will laugh at your calamity. I will mock when your fear cometh. When your fear cometh as desolation and your destruction cometh as a whirlwind, when distress and anguish come upon you, then shall they call upon me. But I will not answer. They shall seek me early, but they shall not find me. For that they hated knowledge, true knowledge, good knowledge, righteous knowledge, and did not choose the fear of the Lord. Brethren, there's going to be a rude awakening to all those who reject the ideals of the great moral authority of the universe. The seat of the scornful is a seat that we do not want to sit in. It denotes a higher and more determined level of wickedness and refers to the consummation of a depraved character. It's the last stage of wickedness when God and sacred things are mocked, are held in contempt with derision. And with this seat, brethren, comes condemnation, punishment. Let's turn to Proverbs in chapter 9, over a few chapters. Now, have you ever debated with one who rejects God and the Bible? Have you ever held one of these conversations? You can't talk to these people. You really can't. And if you do, they're not going to listen. Or it may seem like they're listening, but the types of responses they will give will show that they are not hearing what you're saying to them. It's kind of like pulling teeth to talk to these people. Like speaking to a brick wall. Only this brick wall speaks back and sometimes throws a brick back at you. Proverbs from chapter 9 and verse 7 speaks of this particular type of person and says, he that reproveth a scorner getteth to himself shame, and he that rebuketh a wicked man getteth himself a blot. So if you try to correct or instruct someone that has utter contempt for God, you're going to get hurt. These people are hateful, angry people that are just looking for someone to take their anger out on. Most likely you're going to initially get hurt with some kind of emotional abuse that they might try to inflict on you, but it also it says if you try to correct the wicked person here in the end of this verse, you may get punched. Calls it a blot. You might get hit in the face. Because many times they won't have an answer and they might just use physical force to release their anger. The English Standard Version of this particular verse, Proverbs 9:7 says, whoever corrects a scoffer gets himself abuse, and he who reproves a wicked man incurs injury. I think that helps us to put a little more into perspective. So if this kind of corrective instruction is given to one who seeks pure and honest wisdom, righteous wisdom, you're going to get a far different response from these type of people, right? Like one of us. Proverbs 9 and verse 8 says, "Reprove not a scorner, lest he hate thee." Then it says, "Rebuke a wise man, and he will love thee." Is that how we are? Do we love rebuke? Do we love correction? We really should, if we don't. Because it's to the better of us. It's to our advantage to be corrected. It really helps us in the long run. And it helps us to secure that seat in God's coming kingdom. Those who seek truth and wisdom will accept correction, will accept reproof and instruction. And these are three of the four things that the scriptures say the Bible is good for. Reproof, correction, instruction. And this should be us, shouldn't it? We should love it when correction comes, but we often don't. It's often very painful for us, hard to accept. Often we get angry or offended when somebody corrects us. But, brethren, I say that it's time to accept it. It's time to accept it and love that which is purposed to build us up, to strengthen us, to make us better Christians, better people, better brothers and sisters, better husbands, better wives, better children. That's the purpose of correction. It's not to inflict pain upon us. It's not to hurt us. It's done out of love. It really is. And those whom God may use to deliver this correction to us, they're not against us. They really aren't. They're on our side. They want what's best for us, as God wants what's best for us. They're not trying to tear us down. It's not to ridicule us or cause us some kind of emotional hurt. Sometimes this happens, but that's not the purpose of correction. It really is not. It's for our better. It's for our good. It's for our benefit, actually. It's for the benefit of us, and it's also for the benefit of all of us as a family of faith. It's for the benefit of the church. The church also needs to be corrected at times, as we've seen in the years past. And it's for the good of the church, the good of the people. It's not to hurt anybody. That just sometimes happens. People get hurt. But we need to try to not take it this way, to take it for what it is. It's done out of love. Remember when David fled Jerusalem, when his son Absalom was trying to take the kingdom? And there was a man, as David was traveling on the way, his name was Shimei. And this man was throwing stones at David and yelling at him and calling him a bloody man, basically calling him a murderer. Now, David could have had this man's head for doing this. I mean, he was still the king. He could have had this man killed for doing that. But he didn't, did he? He didn't. He said, "No, let it go. This might be from God," is what he said. "God might be using this man to correct me." The example for us, brethren, is that David realized God can and does use people to correct us. And we should also be willing to accept this kind of correction when it may come. Let's turn over to Matthew in chapter 23. Matthew in chapter 23. So can we, brethren, as Christians, can we sit in the seat of the scornful? Well, I think you know the answer. The answer is yes, we can. How about scoffing at the church leadership because we don't agree with something that's being taught in the church? Now, this is not to say that we can't disagree. We can. But we can't take it to another level, to where we disrespect people, to where we put them down and try to make them look bad in front of others. I mean, God has put people in positions in the church where he wants them to be. And we can't disrespect the positions that people hold in the church, whether it's in this congregation or in any other. We don't attack leaders of other congregations and try to make them look bad. We only try to speak the truth out of love, out of hope for those, for God's people, so that we all may be corrected, that we all may be one, a family of faith. Matthew 23, in verses 2 to 3, Jesus said that the scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. All therefore whatsoever they do, bid you observe, and that do and observe. Then he says, but do not you after their works, for they say not, and they do not. So Christ here first says to do as the ministry instructs you, right? And then he said, but do not follow the bad examples that they may give. Don't do after their works. They were hypocrites. Christ openly called them hypocrites. But he still said to follow the authority that they've been given, because God has allowed them to hold this position. They sit in Moses' seat. He's allowed them to run the synagogues, to instruct the brethren. Hasn't he? But did Christ rebuke them? Oh, yes. Yes, he did on many occasions. But what? Do we think that we are like Christ? Do we sit in the judgment seat that Christ sits in? Over the ministry? Over the brethren? Is that our position? Personally, I would be very afraid to hold that position. To judge anyone. Judge not, lest you be judged. Well, what about our workplace? Can we sit in the seat of the scornful in the workplace? Do we ridicule our co-workers? Or have contempt for our boss behind their back? Maybe talking about them to other people? What about family? Do we treat our family with disrespect? Are we yelling and screaming at them? Are we scoffing at them behind their backs? Yes, we too can sit in the seat of the scornful. Maybe not to the level or the degree that it's being done in the media or in Hollywood, in society, if you will, but we too can sit in this seat. We need to be aware of that. Yes, there's many seats to sit in this world, brethren. Whether it's positions, whether it's places, an actual physical seat, seats of authority, decision-making seats. What kind of seats should we sit in? What kind of seats should we hold? And positions should we hold? Well, let's look at Luke in chapter 14. Luke in chapter 14. The first thing that we need to be aware of is to not sit in the seat that does not belong to us. Luke chapter 14, where Jesus gives a teaching of humility. Beginning in verse 8, it says, "When thou art bidden of any man to a wedding, sit not down in the highest room, lest a more honorable man than thou be bidden of him. And he that bade thee in him come and say to thee, give this man place, and thou begin with shame to take the lowest room. But when thou art bidden, go sit down in the lowest room, that when he that bade thee cometh, he may say unto thee, friend, go up higher. Then shalt thou have worship in the presence of them that sit at meat with thee. For whosoever exalteth himself shall be abased, and he that humbleth himself shall be exalted." So, the example Christ gives here is that we should first sit in the seat of the humble. The seat of the meek. Not of the proud. Look at me, that's my seat over there. I'm taking that one. No. Do not try to place ourselves where we don't belong. The meek shall inherit the earth, not the proud or the lofty. And God has set members, brethren, God has set members, every one of them in the body as it has pleased him, as the scriptures say. Are all the head? Are all the feet? Are all the arms or the legs? No. Are all the pastors? Are all the ministers? Are all the prophets? No, they're not. People hold different positions, and God has put them in those positions. Are all managers? Are all CEOs? No, they're not. It would be a very crazy place if they all were. Are all husbands? Are all wives? And are all children? Well, in a sense, a spiritual sense, we are all children. But I'm talking about the physical family. No, they're not. Families don't function properly when everybody tries to be the husband or everybody tries to be the wife. God has given positions to those whom he has chosen, and it's for a purpose. He built the church for a purpose, and he puts people in positions in the church for a purpose. He constructed the family unit for a purpose. And people hold positions in the family for a purpose. He knows how things work. And his way really works if we just apply it. And if we just do it. His way really works. We need to accept that, brethren. And ultimately, like accepting correction, it's for our benefit. It's really for our benefit. And not accepting where God has put place people in the family, in the church, in the company, not accepting this is akin to rebellion. It's rebellion against God and what he has instructed us to do. It's rebellion against authority. And this, as we all know, as was pointed out in the sermonette by Mr. Sinos, this is the work of the adversary, of Satan. He's the rebel. He's the one that wants to rebel, and he tries to influence us to rebel as well. He's the one that seeks to divide the family and to divide the church. And he tries to influence people to do this as well. Because he wants us to die, as Mr. Sinos pointed out. I thought that was very interesting that he pointed. I mean, I guess I knew that, but I just never really had it put down simply like that. Satan is going to die, and he wants you to die with him. I thought that was a very good point that was brought up in Mr. Sinos' sermonette. Let's turn over to Romans in chapter 14. So, brethren, we should respect the seats that people have been given and work together for good. And find the seat that God wants us to sit in. The seat of the humble, the seat of the meek, the seat of those who love and who cheer other people on. Good for you, Frank. Good for you, David. You know, give people a little bit of encouragement when they overcome, when they get through a trial, or when they're having a trial. That's a wonderful seat to be in. There's nothing like being encouraged when you're going through hard times. It means so much to the individual that people love them and care about them enough and give them a little bit of hope, give them some happiness, some help them gather some strength in these difficult times. It's a wonderful thing, and that's a great seat to be in. In Romans in chapter 14, it says, let us therefore follow after the things, in verse 19, Romans 14, verse 19. Let us therefore follow after the things which make for peace, and things wherewith one may edify one another. Yes, brethren, Let's follow after these things. If we truly seek to edify one another, seek to exalt one another, we're going to prosper. We're going to be happy. We're going to have love. And we're going to gain wisdom. The scriptures say that this is so. In doing this, we're going to bear spiritual fruits according to our works. Let's turn back to Psalms in chapter 1 where we had begun. Psalms in chapter 1. Yes, we can bear spiritual fruits by seeking to love, to edify, to exalt one another, and not to ridicule or mock. Psalms chapter 1, and I'm going to read, begin reading in verse 2. Verse 2 and 3, I'll just add the first part in there. Blessed is he that delights in the law of the Lord, and in his law doth he meditate day and night. And he shall be like a tree planted by the rivers of water, that bringeth forth his fruit in his season. His leaf also shall not wither, and whatsoever he doeth shall prosper. So, brethren, is our delight in the law of the Lord? Do we meditate on it day and night? As we work? As we drive to the store? As we conduct business? As we read a book or watch a movie? Are we meditating kind of in the background about God's law and seeing how it applies to the many different situations that we go through in life? It's something we need to do. And it often happens automatically to those who truly seek righteousness. And if it doesn't, try to do this. Really, truly, God's law applies to virtually everything we do in life. Everything. And it's there for us. It's there to govern our every step that we take. Let's turn to Revelation in chapter 3 for the final scripture today. Revelation in chapter 3. We shall prosper in doing this, brethren, in meditating on God's law and finding delight in the law of the Lord. And in doing this, we will bring forth fruits in due season. And the season is soon approaching, I might add, that the first fruits are going to be harvested. And then these first fruits are going to be given their seat of reward. Let's think about this. Revelation chapter 3, beginning in verse 19. Christ says to us, "As many as I love, I rebuke and chasten. Be zealous, therefore, and repent. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If any man hear my voice and open the door, I will come into him, and I will sup with him, and he with me. To him that overcomes will I grant to sit with me in my throne, even as I also overcame and am set down with my Father in his throne. He that hath an ear to hear, let him hear what the Spirit says unto the churches." This is us, brethren. He's talking to us. He's talking to you. He's talking to me. Let's listen, brethren, to the correction of Christ, recognizing that this correction may sometimes come through other people that God chooses to use. Let's repent and let's open that door when Christ knocks. Do this and overcome, brethren, and when Christ returns to claim his bride, we will have a seat, not with the ungodly, but with Christ in his throne.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you found the message beneficial. If you would like to know more about the Eternal Church of God, we would like to hear from you. You may contact us at 1-800-723-6108. We also invite you to visit our website at eternalcog.org. Once again, thanks for listening.